You know, Bev, I'm really tired. I could use a pick-me-up.
Have you heard of Spark Plug Coffee?
What is that?
Well, rejoice, Ryan, and fellow Canadians. No longer are you beholden to the selection offered by your grocery store or forced to make special trips to your local hipster Java joint. Spark Plug Coffee offers delivery all over Canada of freshly roasted, high-quality beans right to your door. Spark Plug custom roasts your beans to order so that it's always fresh and consistently delicious.
And how do I acquire this product?
Just go to their website, sparkplugcoffee.com, to get started.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy New Year, Top 100 Project fans. Welcome to our podcast as we plug away at reviewing the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 greatest American motion pictures. Go pick your feet in Poughkeepsie and come back later if you don't like spoilers. I am Ryan Ellis with my partner in crime prevention, Cloudy Bev Ellis.
That's me.
The coming attractions trivia for The French Connection. Popeye Doyle is one of eight law enforcers on the heroes and villains list. How many of those are on the hero side, and who are they?
Oh, curses. I completely forgot to think about this. The only one I can think of, funny enough, is the one that's on the villain side. Antoine something from
Alonzo Harris?
Yep, that's one. That's Denzel, one. I've never actually seen that movie.
You're correct. The only villainous cop. Day. The only villainous cop.
So the other seven are...
Seven of the eight are our heroes.
I can't name them.
We got Will Kane from High Noon. Gary Cooper's character. Clarice Starling. Jodie Foster from Silence of the Lambs. Dirty Harry Callahan. Clint Eastwood from, of course, Dirty Harry. They call him Virgil Tibbs from In the Heat of the Night. You betcha, Marge Gunderson from Fargo. Rooster Cogburn from True Grit. Frank Serpico, Al Pacino, in the movie, of course, named Serpico. Lots of cops, only one dirty one. Although this one is very gray area, and that will be a theme in this movie.
Definitely.
Which is the Top 100 Project's 82nd movie, The French Connection, which was 70th on AFI's 1998 Top 100. Between Shane and Forrest Gump, then took a big plunge to 93rd in 2007 between 1990s crime films and beloved ones at that, Goodfellas and Pulp Fiction. Fox gave The French Connection a two-pronged premiere in New York City and L.A. on October 7, 1971, right around the same time as our last week's film, The Last Picture Show. Then the film was released on October 9th. It didn't even cost $2 million to make, but hauled in a lot of Benjamin Franklin's. Bev will describe the film now for you with the skinny.
Gene Hackman is Jimmy Popeye Doyle, a hot-headed, racist New York narc hot on the trail of drug dealers from France. Fernando Rey is the smooth criminal responsible for importing the smack. Roy Scheider is Popeye's sensible, straight-laced partner, Buddy Cloudy Russo. The investigation gets more dangerous and more violent as the Frenchman continually eludes the frustrated cops.
Or in a nutshell, Santa Claus impersonator pulls a gun on European importer-exporter.
But the Santa Claus... Oh, because he's impersonating Santa at the beginning of the movie. Yep. And later on the importer-exporter. Mm-hmm. That is a stretch, sir.
One of those nutshells you better know the movie to get any of that.
Yeah, really.
Okay, 98% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes. 50 fresh, only one rotten. 88% of audiences, pretty solid scores. What about Beverly Ellis' score?
I have to confess, I just don't like gritty cop movies all that much. So it's hard to get behind the original gritty cop movie. I found the first half hour incomprehensible. The whole film is unnecessarily complicated, especially since the details of the drug deal are ultimately irrelevant. And I found Popeye Doyle so detestable that I just never found myself invested. But I'll give the film huge kudos for the innovation, and I may not like it, but it's definitely a respectable genre, and many, many people love the gritty cop drama.
There are two things this movie influences more than anything else, and there's about seven or eight influences I think I might have on my list, but two main ones. One is the infamous car chase, where Popeye is chasing the elevated train, and the other one would be what we've already talked about, and that is a cop who is very close to crossing the line, and in that chase, that's where it really goes over the top. Where he's putting the public at risk by trying to get this criminal.
I would say he crosses the line. I don't think it's even a gray area, and I think that's what Friedkin intended. They really don't go out of their way to make him remotely sympathetic. And they have all these opportunities. They even set it up to make him sympathetic. You know, they give him a nickname. They never explain it. they talk about the good cop that he got killed, but they never have that scene where he wistfully looks out the window and talks about that mistake that he made that he forever regrets. Opportunities to get to know him in a way that would personalize him, that would make him just a little bit likable. He isn't. I don't think he's meant to be.
There are two things about that I'm going to address in what you just said. One would be the not likable looking out the window wistful moment. I'm glad for that. The second part of that was actually the first thing you said, which is a nickname.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently what that comes from is not the eating your spinach, olive oil, kind of guy. What that refers to is that when he goes in somewhere, his eyes are popping out of his head because he's looking around. He's always doing the job.
Oh.
And in this scene early on, when he and Cloudy go to the Copacabana, and that's the place we're going to see in Goodfellas, we see them in Bed-Stuy, which is where Do the Right Thing is set. A lot of New York settings. This movie is all over New York City, and we've seen so many AFI movies that have been. This one truly is, really, truly set in that city, all around different parts of it, Manhattan and Bed-Stuy, Copa. But when he goes into these places, he's always working. He's always just having a drink with his buddy. His eyes are popping out of his head. So that's where that comes from.
Yeah, he's absolutely obsessed. He's a very interesting character.
Mm-hmm. But kind of like a guy we did a couple weeks ago, General George S. Patton. He is incredibly great at his job. One fighting in war, and this one hunting drug dealers. But neither of them are very good at regular life.
I think, like I did when we talked about Patton, I'm going to dispute he's actually that good at his job. Because his job is to serve and protect. And I just don't think that keeping that heroin off the street is going to negate the danger he puts the public in.
That's the funny thing about narcotics. Now, here's you and I, we're people that are basically on the side of making pot at least legal, at the very least. What in the world?
Yeah, we're not drug users. We just think it's so stupid.
And we are Canadians, so it's a different mentality anyway than Americans seem to have. But even with something like heroin, coke, or the more serious ones, it is something that generally, and let's not get into politics this too far, but it generally only hurts you. You're not killing people on the street. This isn't about somebody who's raping somebody. This isn't a Bill Cosby situation or a Gian Gomeschi situation where people might be at risk from being hurt by this person. As bad as drugs are and as illegal as they were then, they still are now, it's just hard to watch a movie in 2014 where a guy is doing something as much as it's his job and respect that, where you think, you're not helping anything.
Yeah.
Traffic, the movie that was released almost 20 years later, 19 years later, in fact.
Steven Soderbergh.
And it probably should have won the Best Picture Oscar, certainly over Gladiator at least. And that movie had that point of view which says the drug war failed miserably. Yeah. And that's what this movie's also about, too. It's about the drug war that isn't working.
And in this day and age, public opinion has really turned against the drug war. It's happened really quickly. It feels suddenly to those of us that are outside the fight. Suddenly politicians are getting behind legalizing pot and even just chilling out on the aggression that they use to pursue harder drugs like cocaine and heroin.
Let's take a bit of a break here while we're talking about this. Let me have my rye and coke, the legal drug, both of those in fact.
And our sponsor is a caffeine peddler. There are plenty of
the morality
of drugs.
Very dubious.
I mean, come on. And also in this day and age, racist, brutal cops. Mm-hmm.
He uses
are
the N-word.
Not heroes. He uses the N-word. I think we don't even hear the N-word in Gone with the Wind, do we?
No, because they couldn't say it back then.
Oh, I see. It was a swear word even in the 30s. It's just so abrasive to hear now coming out of a quote-unquote hero's
He doesn't
mouth.
Say fuck very often, but he does at least once. And he doesn't say the N-word very often, but he does a couple of times in that scene. I guess a parallel to another cop movie of sorts.
Do you remember the line that he uses when he uses the N-word, what he's saying? He says, never trust them.
Oh, that's right. When he says to Cloudy. Doesn't he also say it, though, in the scene I'm about to talk about, which is in the shakedown scene, where he has to go to his informant. He has to pretend like there's this big shakedown of all the drug users,
and
maybe even pushers, but really just users in this bar. And it's all about getting to the informant in the bathroom, which is a nicely played scene, actually.
I'd say, that is a good
place. That's where the Popeye's here.
Mm-hmm.
He rarely calls himself Popeye. His partner, Cloudy, Roy Scheider, rarely calls him that. He calls him Jimmy a few times. That's his actual name, Jimmy Doyle. But that's where I remember hearing the N-word more than once, and I think he said fuck at least once. But then again, those two words aren't laced throughout this. We're going to cover Pulp Fiction many, many months from now, and there's a guy who uses the N-word and the F-word constantly, Quentin Tarantino. As much as we've enjoyed him, he probably overdoes it.
Yeah, and he has white people saying it, too, like in a way that no matter how down they're supposed to be, it makes you uncomfortable. One might say that it is not intentional, the discomfort that you feel watching that movie. But I think the public has just become less and less accepting of language like that coming from anybody, especially cops. So it's not like a good year to watch The French Connection for the first time.
Yeah, right, of course. This has been a rough year. Every year, I suppose, is rough on people who aren't white in North America, especially in the United States of America. This year in particular has been a rough one. All these things got the movie an R rating. It's the first R-rated Best Picture Oscar winner, although if you want to go by Midnight Cowboy being re-rated around this time, I think it was, actually, a couple years after it came out, then technically that's the first R-rated movie, but it was NC-17 when it won the award. And this one has those controversial moments, not a ton of them.
Midnight Cowboy was rated X, not NC-17. There was no NC-17.
You're right, didn't exist then, of course, yeah. So French Connection earned that rating. It also earned the third most money at the 1971 box office. We talked about this last week when we did Last Picture Show. Billy Jack, a movie that you never heard of, and I've only seen once and don't remember, was number one. French Connection was number three. Last Picture Show was number seven. And the movie we do next week, A Clockwork Orange, was number nine. So our three AFI films all ranked in the top 10. But this movie, unlike A Clockwork Orange, Last Picture Show, or almost anything we've ever done in the entire project, or will do to come on the project, is an action film. Now, it's a different pace. It's not nearly what we see in action films now. I made a very short list of movies that you could call action films. The General, the first ever action movie
we did. It's action comedy. Yeah.
Right. And then we did Die Hard not long after as a Not 100 Project film, which is obviously an action film. And we even compared the two. Raiders of the Lost Ark, we'll do that in about mid-2015. Clearly an action film. This one, different pace, but okay, action film. The other two, debatably, Jaws and King Kong. But they're more monster movies, action adventure.
I would call them action movies. I say they fit in.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you could probably name five or ten others. And the Thrills list is the best place to look for this. So the Thrills list, top three or four, Psycho, Jaws, Exorcist, not really truly action films. But this one has a different pace. The biggest action scene, and the most famous scene in this movie for sure, is the chase.
The infamous car chase.
William Friedkin, this was one of his first movies. He'd made a few before. Kind of like last week's director, Peter Bogdanovich, had made other movies, but his 1971 film absolutely put him on the map. They were up against each other for the Best Picture Oscar and Best Director Oscar and everything else.
He was also a young man, and he had the ear of a Hollywood pro, Howard Hawks, because at the time he was dating Howard Hawks' daughter. The story goes that he had asked Hawks if he liked any of the films he had made already. Hawks just straight up said no. And then his mission making French Connection was to make a film that he would like.
Howard Hawks actually did a draft of the screenplay. We haven't talked about Hawks much the last little while.
No, no.
The last long while. He's only done one film, was Bringing Up Baby so long ago. Unlike this one entirely. Another movie from that same year, released only a few weeks later, Dirty Harry, which has similar subject matter. We talked about Dirty Harry already in The Coming Attractions. He's one of the hero cops. Another Shades of Grey cop, probably more on the side of doing the right thing, unlike this one. Have you ever seen Dirty Harry?
No, no. I'm a lady, so. It's not something me and my girlfriends rent on the week.
I guess the point I'm bringing up here is that this is where you started seeing the cops be tougher, trying to fight crime harder. And what Eastwood talks about in some of the making ofs in that movie, which of course were recorded about 30 years later, is that he's standing up for the rights of the victims. We never see people doing drugs in The French Connection, but I suppose Popeye can make the same argument. He's standing up for the little guy who's getting stomped by the Alain Charniers of the world, the Frog Ones.
So when I was trying to figure out why he was as obsessed as he was, because the movie doesn't really make it clear like what the source of his obsession was, some of the reviews suggest it was because he had gotten a cop killed before, because he was only really making small busts, that his career depended on it. Yeah. Although I can't believe that that was the only thing really behind his obsession, because it is singular. Like you said, in every single scene he's working, even when he shouldn't be.
Yeah, we see him at one point completely blasted. He's been drinking, it seems like, all night. He wakes up with his head down in the bar. He's fallen asleep that way. But otherwise, he's always working in some form or another. I don't think we said this in the beginning. This movie is based on real events, real people. Eddie Egan. And Sonny Grasso, that's where the sunny, cloudy thing comes from, a little play on that. And these guys actually had a case very similar to this. It wasn't exactly the same. It didn't end the way this one does, where the two characters are split up. And at the end, we see that title card. It doesn't really explain why.
Yeah.
They made this bust. They've got the car full of heroin. We'll get to that whole detail later on. But why were they split up? They're a good team.
Maybe it's because of the ending that we haven't really talked about yet. Popeye, without a shred of remorse, accidentally, carelessly kills an FBI agent.
And doesn't even blink.
Doesn't care at all. He just moves on and goes out to find his target.
And then he's shooting a ghost at the very ending. And spoiler alert, Frog One, Alain Charnier, in French Connection 2, he goes on to live and he gets back to France and they hook up again. And that movie, as I recall, I wrote a review. Maybe I should include that as a link on the website. And I don't want to give away that film, which I don't even recall how it ends at the moment. But I do know there's a harrowing drug scene, forced drug scene. So both Popeye and Frog One are in part two, but no Cloudy. But in the ending of this film, I love the creepy Blair Witch-esque location.
Yeah.
If they'd actually lingered on those details, it might have reminded us of that film a little bit more. Because it's a lighted but terrifying looking warehouse.
Yeah, like abandoned.
What has happened there?
That's a good question. And the New York in this movie is not Central Park and Grand Central Station. Mm. It's Brooklyn, but Brooklyn in the 70s. Mm. It's an ugly part of New York at a time in New York's history when it was an unsafe place to live and to be, and probably Midnight, to be a cop.
And Midnight Cowboy a couple years before also won Best Picture, as this one did. Another one that's about seedy New York. Taxi Driver is clearly about seedy New York. That city changed a lot in reality and in the movies in about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about the ending, and then we'll get back to the chase scene. When the movie's over, there's no real climax. This is a great example of what Altman said about movies in general, at least his movies. They just stop. The characters aren't done.
That's just when we stop following what they're up to. Yeah.
Because the last thing we see Popeye do is he goes in the dark, we hear a gunshot. We don't hear anything else. We don't know if he's hit anything. He probably hasn't. So did you feel differently at the end of this movie about his character than you did as it plays out? Because he is shot at earlier by the Nicolai character.
Mm-hmm.
The hitman we see in the very beginning who kills a French cop. And then he's in New York later on. And he's part of that big subway chase.
I like that the movie really had the guts to go there and to make him despicable. As much as I think it probably didn't help me like the film any better, I respect that they had the guts to do something like that. And it's not just that death when he kills the FBI agent by mistake. Cops had a big problem with this movie because of when he kills the hitman.
Yep.
He shoots him in the back. Mm-hmm. It's murder, right? And a lot of cops were like, we wouldn't do that. That is murder. No cop would get away with that. But apparently Eddie Egan, who is the basis for Doyle, was on set. So that's why Friedkin felt like it's authentic.
He liked it. Audiences liked it. And you know who else likes it? Maybe you can't hear it, but that police siren down the street. And we won't stop recording and wait for that to go away this time because that fits into the theme of this podcast.
If it picks up.
Probably can't hear it anyway.
What do you think of the ending?
I like the ending of the film because it was different. Even now, you don't see a lot of movies that end this way.
Yeah.
Where he has crossed that line. And the director knows it. William Friedkin talks about it in the commentary, the documentary, all the stuff. It's a really good DVD and or Blu-ray where you get all kinds of great inside information from this film. But the sequel goes into different directions than this one does. It just shows how much more obsessed he is to go all the way to France. I won't go into the sequel any more than I already have. Get back to this film. I did find it kind of dour. I've seen it many times.
Mm-hmm.
Of the three movies we cover, it is the one I probably would want to watch least. And by the way, we watch Clockwork very soon, and our first ever AFI Top Runner film during the project we will watch on the big screen.
Yeah, we just have the good fortune that they happen to be doing a big Kubrick exhibition at the Toronto Film Festival Lightbox Theatre, which is open all year round in Toronto. So I'm pretty jazzed about that. They have a whole exhibit, artifacts from the films. And
that's our first film from 2015 that we will have on the project. And that's a movie that we're going to see again as we get older in the next 10 or 15 years. I'm not saying we'll never watch this one again, but after seeing it yet again, I don't really feel any huge need to see it. The authenticity in some ways feels less authentic. You even made a wisecrack about it. They show the scenes that do beat it to death. Charnier and Nicolai are having this great meal, this long European lunch. Seems like it lasts for hours. And then outside we see Popeye on stakeout, stamping his feet, trying to stay warm, drinking terrible coffee. He can't even drink this horrible coffee that would do something to keep him warm.
Mm-hmm.
Or eating this horrible looking pizza.
Yeah, the greatest piece of pizza I've ever seen.
This New York known for its pizza. Yes, yeah. And how he finds a terrible piece.
Oh, it looks so nasty.
So the movie really beats that to death. He has the shitty apartment and he has the shitty living arrangements and the terrible food. And Charnier, this drug dealing criminal from another country as well, you stupid immigrants, fuck you, is eating so well. But the movie does beat that to death a little bit too much.
That plays into the theme of the class consciousness, too. Popeye is so blue-collar. I mean, everybody in the film is blue-collar. Boca's blue-collar. Boca wants to be rich. He wants to be Alain. He wants to eat those fancy lunches and become part of that world. But he's not. The first time we meet him and his wife, Angie, they're almost in costume. You know, she's wearing a wig. They're pretending to be wealthier than they are.
And this little restaurant that they're running.
Yeah, but the truth is they're like Popeye. But Popeye doesn't want to be rich. You don't get the impression that he's mad that they're
enjoying this
lunch.
You probably couldn't bribe him.
No. When he eats that pizza, he's just like, well, I have to eat to stay alive. He doesn't care the pizza's garbage.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't even look at it. He just eats it as if it's this mechanical function he has to fulfill.
Yeah. You mentioned Sal Boca, Tony LoBianco. He's nearly 80 years old. He's uncredited in Serpico. He's also in The Honeymoon Killers and Nixon. And he is the connection with France.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing those drugs over to America. Well, Gene Hackman, how about this? We haven't really talked about his credits. We've seen him in Bonnie and Clyde. We will see him in Unforgiven. So three AFI films in total. This guy's resume is huge.
Oh, yeah.
Loved him in Hoosiers, loved him in Royal Tenenbaums, one of his last major films. I wish he'd ended on that note. Such a different film for him. He was funny in that movie, didn't do a lot of comedies. He didn't quite end on that note either. Welcome to Mooseport, as his swan song, unfortunately. But one of my favorite actors because he was so damn believable. James Caan and Peter Boyle could have had this role. They turned it down. Peter Boyle especially could have had this role, and he said no. But ironically, Boyle and Hackman did Young Frankenstein together 3 years later. Huh. Boyle plays the monster, and Hackman plays the hermit. I was going to make espresso. Hackman had major problems playing the racist, violent character, and the interesting connection with future AFI film that he could have directed and starred in is Silence of the Lambs. He at one point had the rights to have played Hannibal Lecter and to direct it. He's not a director at all. I don't think he's ever directed anything. But he had been in Mississippi Burning, got a Best Actor nomination for that film, and apparently at the Oscars, when he saw the scene they used as his Gene Hackman in Mississippi Burning, he was repulsed by what he watched himself do and thought, I can't do any more violent scenes. So he passed on doing that film in the end.
Wow.
So how about that?
He's so good and natural at it.
And the three AFI films, he's a violent, gun-toting character.
That's interesting. I was reading an interview with Friedkin that he did when he was promoting Killer Joe just a few years ago in The Guardian, I think it was. He was saying that his impulse towards violence is so strong that if he didn't have film as an outlet, he would probably have been a serial killer.
Friedkin said that.
Yep. And he asserts that every person has this violent tendency and everybody needs some kind of outlet, or just like him, they would be at risk of lashing out and committing violent acts, which I don't agree with at all. Evidence to the case that Hackman is repulsed by this violence.
Except he did live through his violent characters and some of his more famous ones.
Yeah, oh yeah. His most famous characters really are kind of despicable.
And even in Hoosiers and Royal Tenenbaums. In Hoosiers, he had assaulted a kid who was a player on his team many years before, and he's a tough coach at the very least for the whole movie. In Royal Tenenbaums, he's a terrible father, not a violently abusive type of person, but not a good dad.
Not a good person in general either.
He did play a lot of tender characters, as great as he was as an actor. I love his pork pie hat. We saw that with Buster Keaton in The General, and we also know it from the symbol of Heisenberg in Breaking Bad.
Oh, of course, which is probably one of the many things that has been at least a little bit influenced by that, although when it comes to television shows, I would say there is one massive influence from French Connection, and that is The Wire. You can't not think about The Wire when you're watching French Connection. There's so many similarities. It's clearly derivative.
The Wire is so beloved by everybody. Even now, it's still thought of as the best TV show of all time by some people.
I also did not love The Wire. Couldn't get into it.
Also pretty dense.
Yes, and hard to follow. Almost aggressively hard to follow.
The funny thing about subtlety is that they have that scene early on, the unexplained moment where they throw the straw hat in the back of the car.
Yeah, what was that?
That indicates that they're working. So another cop wouldn't pull them over or get in the way or anything else.
Oh.
It's not explained in the film in any way. I believe it's on the documentary or the commentary. I know I've heard it somewhere. But that's what that straw hat moment means. They don't highlight it. They don't have a big zoom in to say, oh, there's a hat back there. But they do show that Cloudy throws it in the back.
That's a great little Easter egg for somebody who wants to watch the movie over and over again. Mm-hmm. Like, those are the kinds of details that make a film just forever rewatchable.
Yeah.
I guess I just wish it had been easier to follow. It took me so long to get into it because I didn't know what the hell was going on.
But as far as that straw hat goes, I bring it up because I want to make this point. I don't know if this was an influence for French Connection, but when I bought the car that we own, I put a baseball cap in the exact same position of our car, which is still there to this day. And I don't know if it was based on French Connection or not, but it was so I can indicate which car was mine in a parking lot when I didn't know it very well at that time.
Oh.
And I left it there ever since, but was I influenced by having seen this movie maybe recently before?
Huh.
The guy throwing the hat, Roy Scheider, the first of two AFI films. He's going to be, of course, in Jaws.
Yes.
I've said this for so long. This is my idea. I'm not stealing this from anybody else. That the character in this film, because the character in Jaws is our New York cop.
Yes, that's
He's so sick of the bullshit in there. He said, you can't fight crime. And he goes off to fight giant sharks and Annie instead. So there's no literal connection. French Connection and Jaws are not supposed to be related. They're not even the same studio. But I like that idea that that's what this guy did. And Roy Scheider had a hell of a career, too. Not quite as impressive as Hackman's. He was never a big star like Hackman got to be. But he was in Sorcerer, William Friedkin's, not quite follow-up, but one of his 70s films, and very underrated. You should see it. It's based on Wages of Fear. I think I mentioned on this podcast before. Both of those are great. Wages of Fear is a fantastic foreign film, and Sorcerer is a pretty great adaptation by Friedkin. Scheider was also in All That Jazz a couple years after that. 2010, the follow-up to 2001, Space Odyssey, and I love his small role in RKO 281 as a studio boss for Orson Welles. And then the bad guy, Fernando Rey, who's actually a Spanish actor.
Yeah, that's right. He's a Buñuel regular.
He was miscast. Friedkin wanted another actor that he had seen in Belle du Jour.
And they got the name wrong.
The casting department got the name wrong, and they got this guy instead. Now, do you know the name of the actor they actually wanted?
Oh, Francisco something.
Oh, you got that right. Yeah, yes. Not a famous name. Francisco Rabal.
Yeah. And this guy, not only did he not speak French, he didn't speak English either. I think they dubbed his voice for the...
They dubbed his French accent. Yes. They didn't like that enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
His English they were okay with. He didn't speak English that much anyway. But his French was dubbed by someone else. So here we go again. Singing in the Rain, My Fair Lady, West Side Story.
Yeah.
Although those are all musicals, all coming up again where somebody is dubbed.
And didn't he get a nomination for his performance?
Scheider did for supporting actor.
Oh, right. It was Scheider. Okay, I knew someone.
But in
did.
A way, maybe it should have been Ray. I like Scheider
no,
in this film.
No, because it was not his voice. It's someone else's voice.
Well, maybe that's why. Maybe they found out. Well, Ray worked for almost 60 years in the business. He was in The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie,
mm-hmm.
a film if you've not seen. It's very interesting, and I won't say anything more about it. Boonwell did that one, too. And as I said before, he's in French Connection, Pot Deux. His hitman, Marcel Beauzevy, he's the guy who plays Nicolie, and he's in Z. We would say Z here in Canada, but Z, the movie that was made a few years before this, a Costa Gavras film, which is an absolute influence on this one.
Yeah, yeah, Friedkin even said himself.
The immediate sort of documentary-style filmmaking and the violence and just kind of capturing things on the move. There's even small roles for Egan, the real Popeye Doyle, who plays Simonson, their boss, and Sonny Grasso, who plays Klein. That's the cast I want to talk about, but let's get back. We buried the lead, the most famous in this film, and that would be the big chase. Friedkin has acknowledged he wanted to top Bullet, which was a couple years before this film. The same producer of that film, in fact. And then he tried to top it himself in his own film, Friedkin did, To Live and Die in L.A. But this movie being on the thrills list is almost entirely based on this infamous chase scene. What do you think of that part of the film?
Oh, I really liked it. It's as great as everybody says it is. It's just so effective. My only complaint, and this isn't really about the chase scene, is that by then, because I just hated Popeye so much, I didn't really feel invested enough to care about the outcome of that chase.
Did you kind of hope that Nicolie would actually shoot him from the rooftop? Because that's how that scene starts. This sniper is trying to kill him. He's not a very good shot, obviously.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's wait until there's a woman pushing... There's so many baby carriages in danger in this movie, but let's wait until there's a woman pushing a baby carriage right beside him to pull the trigger. That's actually pretty stupid that the reason Popeye's wise to him, the reason he gets made, is because he kills this woman.
He can't wait another few seconds. No. Shot at him.
It's kind of stupid and unnecessarily violent. It's not like I wanted Popeye to die, but by the time the chase is happening, I don't really care for him to succeed, and I really watched it from that point of view of somebody who's just seen a cop overreach his authority so much that he's putting people in danger, which is what you're supposed to see. You're supposed to interpret the scene as an exciting scene, but is it even legal for cops to just stop somebody and take their car?
The cop cliche!
Let's settle this once and for all. This is not
Hold it! I'm the police! Taking your car!
At least for once, the guy's like, when do I get my car back? Which is, he's just like...
You don't, buddy.
You don't. Oh, Dad! I feel so bad for the people who get stuck giving their cars up to cops, but does that ever happen? So he takes this poor guy's car and just absolutely annihilates it, doesn't care about his own safety, about the safety of the other cars on the road. I've read that that woman pushing the baby carriage, the infamous shot of him just barely missing this woman in the baby carriage, she was just a standby, like she wasn't an actress.
That was planned. They wouldn't risk that. Friedkin did this movie and did this scene without enough proper permits. We said it was an on-location film, and it absolutely was. They did this sequence out of order and over the course of many weeks. It took a hell of a long time to shoot this sequence, and if you watch it, it makes sense. We really break it down. That they wouldn't have taken a chance with, but when the car hits him at one point, that apparently was a real car. Because New York drivers say, I don't care if you're filming, it's New York, screw you. And if you have the proper permits, you have cops blocking off areas and you have all kinds of ways that people can't get involved in the filming. But they didn't really do that properly. And also people have talked about, if you really look at this closely, we love New York, we've been there twice, we don't know it this well. We certainly don't know Brooklyn this well. But if you look closely, you'll see some of the same things in the background, which again, a movie staple. People do that all the time.
Oh, really didn't notice that.
A train movie. This is a train movie, but an actual train.
Yeah,
movie.
Yeah.
If you watch, you'll probably see the same background over and over again in that situation too, because they'll back up the train and reshoot something. But that woman was an actress. The one who hits the car apparently was not, and some other near misses.
We're just legit drivers.
And of course, Hackam's not driving through almost any of it because they'd have to get a stunt driver.
Yeah,
I do love when they put the camera on the front of that car and you feel like you're in a roller coaster for
they
that
They shot
few
at
seconds.
18 frames a second. I never noticed.
I didn't know.
I usually pick up on stuff like that, but I didn't notice. Really well done. And it was very meticulously planned. I guess he didn't want to be cobbling together a bunch of whatever they happened to shoot that day when they were in the edit suite, so he made sure he got every shot that he needed, and it pays off. That scene is absolutely as good as everybody says.
And then ends with shooting the guy in the back, which Egan and the audience like so much that became the poster shot for this
film. Yeah. something I was reading was pointing out that if this movie were made today, they would never make that the poster shot. It's such an indicative thing of the 70s and just kind of the attitude. It's a nihilistic film. It's almost aggressively without a point or purpose, without any meaning, you know, especially by the end when he kills the FBI agent and then he just runs off and those title cards just kind of, and then this happened.
Which is also true of Unforgiven in a lot of ways, where he plays a cop again, but now he's supposed to be the bad guy. He crosses over from being a good guy to a bad guy in this film, arguably, even though he's a hero cop, according to the AFI. And in Unforgiven, I've had arguments with this for the few people. He's an asshole cop, but he also is the law of that town. And you got assassins who've come in there to bring justice to these guys who've hurt these whores. Oh, they've been misinformed. What really happened to those whores? You could argue, maybe this will be the nutshell for Unforgiven, that this cop was murdered by this vigilante assassin. So the director of this project is the only AFI film, Billy Friedkin. The Exorcist must have been close to making this list, but did not do that. Sorcerer with Roy Scheider. Cruising with Al Pacino and Killer Joe. You mentioned that a few minutes ago. Also To Live and Die in L.A. He was young. He was very cocky. He used handheld cameras. The movie was immediate. It's rough. It's dirty.
I had no idea that Friedkin directed To Live and Die in L.A. And as I was watching French Connection, all I could think about was, man, To Live and Die in L.A. is a total ripoff of this film. It just hits every beat that French Connection hits. Live and Die in L.A. hits right up to the ending, where you have this out-of-nowhere-against-type nihilistic ending to that movie, which a studio made him change and then change back, and there's different versions. When they're testing the heroin for its purity, it reminded me so much of the scene where they're making the counterfeit currency in To Live and Die in L.A. Yeah. And also To Live and Die in L.A., I think I enjoyed watching it, but found it ultimately forgettable and didn't really move me all that much.
The big thing he tried to top himself again with a chase scene is he has William L. Peterson's car going against traffic. So it's one thing to try to chase this speeding train underneath it, which is a cool scene and interesting enough, but now you're going against the traffic, and I'm sure they probably had proper permits to do that. But still, some great stunt driving in that sequence. Bit of a sidebar on Friedkin, though. You're not a big fan of this movie. I know you're not a big fan of The Exorcist, but those are his two big hits. Massive hits at the time. Still thought of as classic films, especially The Exorcist. Between he and Bogdanovich, who I think were friends, and definitely rivals, which one of those two did you prefer?
Oh, Last Picture Show, no contest.
Bogdanovich as a director. Absolutely. And the film itself.
Okay. Yeah.
And that was probably his best contender for Best Picture and Best Director that year. Although Friedkin did win. His writer, Ernest Tidyman, wrote Shaft, which was the same year. Another Shades of Grey cop, although certainly more on the good guy side. Tough, but he's a black guy, and that's why it's different and original. Tidyman also wrote the Shaft sequels and High Plains Drifter for Eastwood. Tidyman based it on Robin Moore's 1969 book. Yet again, a book gets turned into a Best Picture winning movie. And speaking of that, about a book that got turned into a movie, maybe it's not intentional, but there's a Maggio's Lettuce, just like a brand name in the background. And what Best Picture winner had a character named Maggio from a long time ago?
Oh, I don't know.
From Here to Eternity, Frank Sinatra's character.
Oh, okay.
It's probably entirely unintentional.
Yes.
It's probably just some on-location detail that they used, but I just noticed that. I thought I'd write it down. Tidyman won an Oscar for this film, like Ring Lardner Jr. for MASH, for what everyone talks about was a heavily improvised screenplay. Hackman and Scheider and certainly Friedkin talked about this on all the commentaries and DVD documentary stuff. We made that all up on the fly. And I don't know what the real story of that is. Although, Owen Roizman, the cinematographer, claims the dialogue was in the original script. So was it improvised or not?
Oh, it's probably a little bit of both. Everybody wants to take credit for putting their mark on something without acknowledging the skeleton that was there before.
You hear every once in a while the Coen brothers want you to say the screenplay as written. If they've written a stammer or a stutter in there, which they did in Fargo, William H. Macy talks about that, and Peter Stormare talks about that. I have to say the uhs and the ums and the mispronunciations of things. Short of people like that, you're going to make it your own if you're the actor, if you're the director.
It's going to be a lot easier to give a natural performance if you can just improvise a word or a line here and there.
But apparently they improvised this entire fucking screenplay. I don't even know. And as we said, Howard Hawks drafted this one too. He was still around, although his career was pretty much over at this point. The producer, Philip D'Antoni, who did produce Bullet, and then he did Seven Ups, which was a few years later, also had some tough cop chase scenes in it, as I recall.
Had a lot of the actors from French Connection in it.
I think Scheider may have been in it.
Yeah.
But he's made no movies since the mid-70s. Behind the camera, the cinematographer Owen Roizman, who also shot Network and Tootsie, so three AFI films, and of course he shot The Exorcist, which to me of those four is the most memorable looking film.
Yeah, but you got to give French Connection credit for the handheld, the gritty style, setting some new precedents here and breaking new ground.
They use wheelchairs as dollies, all kinds of different situations where they would do that. There's a scene early on where Willie, we talked about picking your feet in Poughkeepsie, that's the big Santa Claus scene.
What they run the guy down. Do you pick your feet in Poughkeepsie?
It's supposed to be the good cop, bad cop thing. Distract the guy. So Cloudy's the good cop. If you just tell us what we want to know, Willie, we'll go easy on you. But you get the bad cop, which is, did you ever pick your feet? Pick where you pick your fucking feet. Tell me what I want to know. Something that Egan would do. But it'd be some weird, has nothing to do with anything type moment where it would just freak the guy out. And the guy who plays Willie plays that pretty well. Yeah. Where it's like, what in the fuck are you talking about?
Like the hat in the back seat is just one of those details that's never explained.
Did you notice that in that scene, though, that Roy Scheider turns towards the camera, a little bit out of focus, but Willie and Gene Hackman can't see him, and he's got the smile on his face, because he's obviously seen this before, and it makes him laugh at that moment. Like, he's
just I didn't notice at all.
He's just fucking with this guy. So Roy's been shot a 1.85:1 color film. And again, we've been talking about how the mid to late 60s, ever since we did The Sound of Music, Dr. Zhivago, huge budget productions, that with some exceptions, most of the movies are more gritty, they're more realistic, some of them are black and white, they're not going for that over-the-top look and style. This Blu-ray, speaking of style, was approved by both Friedkin and Roizman. And the reason I bring that up is because I was reading before we watched the movie, there was a release of this film on Blu-ray that Roizman was pissed about. It looked too blue and he didn't like it at all. I didn't know which one we had. We got this as a gift quite a while ago. But luckily we saw a credit the set approved by both Friedkin and Roizman. And I think the movie looks okay. Yay. Looks fine.
And it's supposed to look gritty, so.
It achieved that.
It's hard to tell.
The editor, Jerry Greenberg, great credits here, did Apocalypse Now, one of the three or four editors on that film.
And a notoriously hard to edit film. The Coppola had days and days of film that they shot.
Walter Murch is maybe the more important editor on that film, but Greenberg had a pretty big role. He also edited that same year, Kramer vs. Kramer, 1979. Scarface a few years later, another big epic film. And Christmas Vacation. How appropriate for the season. I like those credits, though. It's a very weird group of films that he did.
It probably is the type of film where the editor would have had a great deal of input in how it turned out.
This one is.
Yeah, French Connection. Because of all that handheld documentary style. Editing a documentary is this whole different thing. You write the story in the edit suite. Yeah. And I know that isn't the case with this, but when you shoot things documentary style, it's usually just like a mishmash of images, and then you create the scene after the fact.
Well, this is the opposite of last week's film, The Last Picture Show. We talked about that during the podcast. They brought in Bob Rafelson to sort out what Bogdanovich was shooting and realized the guy's cutting this exactly as he needs it. He's doing what Hitchcock did. He's not shooting too much. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying the Friedkin shot too much footage. And if he did, for a film like this, an action film, it's understandable.
He probably didn't because they had such a low budget.
But the point is you'd be able to cobble together more, and you'd need to cobble together more from a film where it's get this little snapshot here, this little moment here, rather than some long take, a movie that's more lugubrious deliberately. Like Last Picture Show.
And the pacing is really well done. I think it was Roger Ebert described French Connection as the whole movie is one long chase scene. He's always chasing Alain and the French criminals. So it's just that the pace of the chase slows down and speeds up.
Ebbs and flows.
And when he says that, it really is true. It really does play out. And the editing helps set the pacing so well.
Kind of like Jaws.
Yes.
In that too.
Absolutely right.
The composer, Don Ellis. Gotta like that guy. Don Ellis. He did 7-Ups for Philip D'Antoni, the producer, French Connection 2. I needed some work before this on Bullet. Don Ellis, way to go, man. Okay, the influence. I think we've talked about quite a bit of it. So we mentioned that Z, with his documentary on the ghost style, influenced this film. The Chase, inspired by Bullet. French Connection 2 with Hackman, directed by Frankenheimer, if I didn't mention that before, who did The Manchurian Candidate.
Oh.
One of your favorites and one of my favorites that we did earlier this year. The 1986 TV movie Popeye Doyle with Ed O'Neill playing Jimmy Doyle. Al Bundy.
Really?
Al Bundy, yeah. The movie definitely influenced very gray area cops.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things would be the informant scene. Eddie Murphy in 48 Hours goes into a bar. It's the reverse where he's the black guy intimidating a bunch of white redneck cowboys.
Yeah.
And he's not a cop. But it's the same kind of idea where this one guy is intimidating a whole bar full of guys who, if they really wanted to, could just take him down, beat him up, and just kill him right then and there. And I'm sure that there must have been some kind of play in 48 Hours on this film.
I wrote in my influence section in my notes, every single gritty cop movie made sense. Because it's true, the blueprint was set here.
And Dirty Harry, which was only a short time later. Mm-hmm. The other one, I didn't know this until reading Popeye's, the chicken joint, is an homage to this character.
What?
I didn't know that. I guess they love this movie that much.
It's because food is displayed with so much love in this
movie. A chicken joint hates French drug dealers, I guess. I don't know.
So weird.
Okay, the awards and other AFI list section. The movie won 5 Oscars. Best Picture, Best Director for William Friedkin, Best Actor for Gene Hackman, his only Best Actor win. The screenplay for Tidyman and Greenberg's editing. The 3 nominations that it didn't win, Scheider for Supporting Actor, the cinematography for Roizman, and the sound. The movie made the National Film Registry in 2005. And the two other AFI lists were that it was 44th on the Bright Side of the Heroes and Villains list for Popeye Doyle as a hero. Very spurious.
Yeah, really.
And 8th on the Top 100 Thrills. It was nominated for the Top 100 Quotes with Have You Ever Picked Your Feet in Poughkeepsie, Willie scene. I guess that wraps it up for French Connection. Any parting thoughts?
I may not have loved this film, but I cannot fail to acknowledge that it was influential in an important genre, important film. It may not be my jam, but I respect it. I really do.
Would you put it on the list?
I just have to trust that it belongs there, according to the opinion of all of these people who are down with this
genre. It dropped 23 spots.
Yeah,
one of the biggest drops of any film that remained on the list. I'm a fan of the movie. It's lost a little bit of steam for me, I think, because I've seen so many other tough cop type movies over the years. But this is definitely a blueprint for what we saw later on. And it's, again, one of the few action films. We talked about a few horror films on this list. But really, bona fide action films, this one, Raiders, we mentioned The General, that's even a little spurious. Jaws and King Kong, also a bit spurious. So maybe 5. Horror films is only 3. Not even 10% of the list are those types of movies that always do well at the box office. What has been the signature of the last maybe 10 or 15 years? Action slash adventure films.
Yeah.
And yet here's a genre that the AFI did not represent very well at all. So this podcast brings us to the end of 2014. We started with the 50s, the very beginning of it, in Sunset Boulevard. Mm-hmm. We've just splashed into the 70s the last couple of weeks. What are your favorite films from this past calendar year?
Oh, this is so hard. Definitely Shane, Manchurian Candidate, All About Eve, Birds on the River Kwai, Dr. Strangelove. How could I possibly forget the love I have for that? Streetcar, going back to that, and Bonnie and Clyde. What about you?
I've always been a big Sunset Boulevard fan. I think I'm more and more as the years go along. Certainly like Streetcar an awful lot. Singin' the Rain is one of my favorites. We both talked about how much we love Shane, a podcast that didn't get a lot of love, but one of the great movies. On the Waterfront, not a favorite for you or some other people we know, but I think it's a fine film. 12 Angry Men, people love that. We do too. Birds of the River Kwai, of course. We saw so much Hitchcock and Wilder at that point, the late 50s, early 60s, and every movie they did was at least good. Psycho is one of our longest podcasts, one of our more in-depth ones. We both love The Manchurian Candidate, so underrated even now. It was cool seeing those big epics for all of their faults. Lawrence of Arabia, Sound of Music, West Side Story, Dr. Zhivago. It was cool seeing the Blu-ray of those films on a decent-sized TV. Yes, it's not the theater, but it was fun to do that. We're going to love Strangelove to the day we die. Virginia Woolf.
Oh, Virginia Woolf. How could I forget?
I'm just making a long list here. Very few films in this past calendar year that I disliked, but some stood out more than others.
Yeah, like American in Paris.
yeah. Unfortunately, we've kind of petered out a little bit. Not that the movies are bad, but MASH, Patton, Last Picture Show, French Connection, the last four we did in 2014, are not necessarily movies that people are really talking about anymore. They either weren't big hits then, or they're just not thought of. MASH and Patton were big hits at their time, but I don't think people really remember them that much now, unfortunately. But we did do an awful lot of zeitgeisty films. 2001 has been a pretty popular download for us, and so was The Shining, a not 100 Project movie we did.
Kubrick, it goes without saying, right? 2001, I love that one too.
What about your biggest surprises?
Oh, maybe Bonnie and Clyde. I don't think I realized how much I was really going to love that one. Mm-hmm. Oh, Bridge on the River Kwai, that's another one. Nobody would have really recommended that movie to me, and I just loved it so much, I found it quite moving.
And I'm guessing your biggest disappointment would be something like On the Waterfront, which had been raved about by so many people and you hadn't seen it yet.
And because I loved Streetcar as well, I was really looking forward to it. There were definitely a few disappointments that would be up there. Hitchcock, I just have to cop to it. I don't like Hitchcock movies. I know, it makes me this sacrilegious. It's like saying you like music and you don't like the Beatles. but I just haven't really, other than Psycho, I did like Psycho.
One of the highest ranked 60s movies on the AFI Top 100 would be The Graduate, a movie that we did not rave about.
No.
I don't know if that movie's really aged all that well, versus something like The Manchurian Candidate, which I think aged pretty well.
Yeah, I can't believe that movie doesn't get more love. It is, oh God, I could watch it again tonight.
Lost,
that's just crazy.
Lost its rank on the list. Yet The Graduate went down only 10 spots. It had been in the top 10, which is nuts. So, a bit of a preview for 2015, and I think people who've been following us know that we've come up with some great titles. The Clockwork Orange will be the very first one we do, our last Kubrick film. The Godfather's only a few weeks later. Chinatown, The Godfather Part 2, Jaws, Cuckoo's Nest, Taxi Driver, All the President's Men's pretty popular, Rocky, Annie Hall, Star Wars, Apocalypse Now, all of those coming up before the end of May.
Yeah.
We still have, of course, all the Spielberg titles. He has a ton of movies. Harrison Ford's in some of those. Harrison Ford is going to be talked about a lot, as is Robert De Niro. And Tom Hanks quite a bit as we get further on into the year. Obviously, the rest of the project will be done in the next calendar year. Less than a calendar year, in fact. We should be done by the end of November 2015. There's not that many left you haven't seen, but one of the most famous titles will be Schindler's List.
Yeah, I've always resisted just because it's a downer. I am the worst. But I just never found that day when I felt like sitting down and spending 3 hours watching a black and white epic about just how depraved humans can be. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't do it.
We also will cover, we're not really sure, 3 or 4, maybe 5 non-100 Project films. Some of them have themes. The first one we'll do in 2015, not that far away from now, as a definite theme.
It's a holiday theme, and that's all I'll say.
We have a few others that we are open to changing. We were manipulated in a good way by our friend Jay from doing something else and doing Dog Day Afternoon instead, which was a good choice, I think. So we're not married to too many other choices, but our final Not 100 Project film, about mid-October, will be a definite choice. So we're open to suggestions for the Not 100s. So that's a review, briefly, of 2014 and a preview of 2015. Look forward to all of those. We hope you'll stay with us, and thanks for being with us all this time. So up next on the Top 100 Project in 2015 is the AFI's favorite 1971 film of the three from 71. It's Stanley Kubrick's final AFI picture, the incendiary black comedy drenched in sex and a little of the old ultraviolence, Clockwork Orange. And we'll be seeing that on the big screen with 4 other friends. What we'll try to do when the movie's over is try to get their thoughts on the film. Maybe we'll include it in the podcast. And one of them is Andre Bajelic, who, of course, we had interviewed for
the Canadian special.
For Cube. He wrote that movie with a few other people. So he'll be the first two-timer on this podcast. Yes. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for Clockwork Orange. It's the relatively rare AFI film not being preserved in the National Film Registry. How many of Stanley Kubrick's other 12 flicks are being preserved by Congress?
Ooh, that's a great question. All right, for the answer to that question, please tune in to next week's podcast for Clockwork Orange. If you'd like more trivia, as well as lots of other fun stuff from Ryan and me, including links to some of the things we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What did you think of The French Connection? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Please send us a message. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsors, Sparkplug Coffee.
Look, I tore everything out of there except the rocket panels.
What the hell is that?
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year, everybody. And cut.